G'day and welcome to the Clean State WA podcast. My name's Anthony James from the Regeneration podcast. On board with you here for this special series dedicated to our home state of Western Australia and the newly released Clean State Jobs Plan. How can we build back better from the coronavirus, avert climate catastrophe, and transition to a regenerative, fair and prosperous Western Australia? I speak here with the West Australians getting it done, the thousands of jobs being created, the success being achieved, and the enormous opportunities that await.
So this really organic alliance is now forming, where our job is to be very clear about what's good for the forests and the forest health in and of itself. And the job of the business sector is to highlight that protected forests are actually better for the Southwest, for social and economic considerations. And together we're telling a pretty powerful story, I think, that the timber industry really is the native forest timber industry, that is, just does not belong in the 21st century. My name's Jess Beckling. I'm the convener and campaign director of WA Forest Alliance, and I'm down on Menang country in Denmark on the south coast of Western Australia.
The WA Forest Alliance is the peak body for forest conservation in WA. And right now, it sees the best opportunity we've ever had to end native logging in this very term of government. A process has begun and we're all invited in to ensure it happens. With the Forests for Life plan in hand, WAFA and Clean State WA show how we can stop bleeding finances, forests and communities and back in our ecologically and economically beneficial industries. I asked Jess to start by locating us a bit through her love of the Southwest forests.
I've lived in and around the Southwest forests for the last 24 years or so, and I feel a very strong dedication to their protection, and with my very deep love and connection to these places, which are so precious.
And did that start? I mean, you mentioned the last 24 years living there in some capacity, but what about earlier in your life? Was the love forged earlier, or at least an instinct for it?
Yeah, I think so. I was raised in South Africa till I was 10. We moved around a lot, but it was always the natural environment that that really held me. And I come from a long line of ecologists and botanists, a lot of scientists going back through my mum's side of the family, and paleontologists and various other sorts of earth scientists. So I think that's come through. And then we moved to Australia, like I said, when I was 10, lived in Perth through high school, and then when I came down to the southwest when I was 18, I was a first year uni student, came into the forest and met some of the people who were working to defend them, and I was equally blown away by their intelligence and capacity and commitment and way of turning difficult circumstances into hope and solutions, as I was by the just complexity and beauty of the forests themselves. So I've been brought into and then maintained my connection through both of those things.
You've been recognised by not just people who care for the forests and who are with you, let's say, in those efforts, but also with a government award that tend to suggest, I guess, an ability on your part to reach across divides. Is that something that you've sort of held close to your methods and your processes?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think synthesizing the various issues and trying to draw them together and understand where the similarities are and how we can forge together and find solutions has always been something that I've tried to bring into the work that I do. So that early award that you're talking about, I think, was the Youth Leadership Award that actually Richard Court at the time was the Premier and was responsible for the policy that was seeing old growth forest logging continue in the late 90s. It was his government who awarded me. So I suppose it must have, although the people who nominated me for that award were quite smart as well in not nominating me for the Environment Award, which was being sponsored by the department who was doing the logging, but for the Leadership Award, which was sponsored by a university. So it meant that I was much more likely to receive it. Yeah.
No, it's a testament to you. So before we delve into some of the detail, let's just lay down why we're speaking today, that the pointed aspect of why we're speaking today in the public survey that's out currently. And you've got a very sort of clear cut umbrella message for people with regards to that survey? Run us through it.
Yeah. So the survey is an absolute breakthrough. We've been campaigning and making very loud noises for a long time about the need to fully protect what's left of the Southwest forests, and really feeling as if we're doing so up against this incredible political inertia that's been in this space for a long, long time. But this survey is the door opening for us to now be able to start that conversation about fully and securely protecting the Southwest forests at a government level. So it's the first step in the development of the next 10-year forest management plan. And it's that's why it's so important, because it's opening the conversation so that that next 10 years of how we manage the Southwest forests can, instead of just being a sort of tinkering at the edges, can be a complete rethink about the way that we're managing the forests. So it's a signal that our campaigning is working, that the state government are hearing the calls from the community, but also from businesses who've been really very vocal and speaking very clearly about the need to protect forests for Southwest sectors like tourism and honey production that rely on protected forests, and also, of course, from scientists, from climate scientists and biodiversity scientists, and from traditional owners. And those calls are now have reached a particular volume and are across such a widespread demographic in the state that government are now listening, and we're making some progress.
So the survey can be, it takes about 20 minutes. It's not overly complex, but there are some, obviously your phrasing of questions come from particular lens, and you'd like to really communicate with people what to look out for and what to emphasise.
Yeah, thanks. So we've been absolutely inundated with requests from people. Within the first 24 hours, I'd had about 100 phone calls and emails from people who said, I'm filling in the survey and there's some really complicated questions and I don't know what to say here. So we've put together a guide that's on our website, wafer.org.au. You can find it under the Get Informed section. And it's been really widely used, and we've had some great feedback from people saying that, which is what we intended, it hasn't been prescriptive. We haven't told people what to say. We trust that people know what they want out of the forest. But we've just tried to give some guidance on some of those particularly tricky questions. The main one is question 3.4, and it puts logging through the lens of the timber industry, which says only 1% is logged per year. So, you know, that doesn't sound that bad if it's creating jobs. Obviously, what that does is completely negates how much has already been lost and how destructive that logging is. They equally could have said, if 10 football fields of Karri and Jarrah forests are being cut down every single day, 10 football fields every day, when is that appropriate? And of course, they would have had a different sort of a response from people who aren't as well informed. So it is very loaded language, and we want people to really be aware when they get to that question that that 1% equals 10 football fields a day. And also, it's happening in the context of 90% of the natural vegetation in this global biodiversity hotspot already having been lost. So yes, we've got this tiny and gorgeous and incredibly precious state forest fringing the coast, so important for climate and water and threatened species and all of the other things that we love about the forests. And no more logging of those precious forests is appropriate.
Yeah, and that's partly now because, as it's been said, the Southwest forests are worth more standing now. Of course, they probably have been for a bloody long time, but in a market sense, they are. So in a sense, the timber industry as it stands looks a bit like coal, where it's just dropping through the floor because we didn't transition well in it. Let's delve a little into how it's become so nonsensical, even from a financial perspective. So yeah, you talked about the cumulative impact, which is vital, and that somehow we've become now the state with the second highest rate of primary deforestation in the country. And particularly with this sort of old, which has always blown me away, this sort of old third world export model, not even a current one, of cut down such an extraordinary, you know, asset, quote unquote, and turn it into wood chips and the like, and that upwards of 80% of it goes to that. But that it's also the timber industry as it stands, native forest timber industry, is operating at a financial loss to the state that's quite significant, in the tens of millions of dollars. How is that passing muster and continuing? What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. It's been a long time since native forest logging was profitable, and it's because of the way that it's been approached, like you said, that export model. And since the 1970s, when wood chipping began in WA, it's been based on this very high volume, low value business model. And we were sold a lie that it was only going to be the residue that was used for wood chipping. And what we've seen now, as you said, is more than 80% of all the timber goes to these incredibly low value products. And, you know, in terms of the social implications, you know, there's fewer than 500 people employed in the sector now, and that number continues to decline. Those jobs are insecure. And people in the timber industry are aware of that. So it really is, you know, the fundamental question of what on earth is going on? How is this being allowed to persist? I think there's a few things there. The first most obvious one is the contracts that the government have entered into, and they've got a certain period of time that they committed to supply that timber for. Some of those even come with state agreement acts, which it makes it increasingly even more difficult for government to extract themselves from. And others come with investment security guarantees, which were 10-year promises on top of current contracts that were introduced by the Barnett government to give industry a little bit more certainty so that they could invest and expand. So there are these legal and financial incumbencies on governments when they want to make policy change, which make it slightly more difficult. But actually, I think that underpinning all of this is more of a cultural problem than a financial or a legal one. I think in WA and around Australia, we still suffer from the terra nullius myth. We still suffer from this idea that the early pioneers and that manly kind of, bringing the bush under control to create safe places for us to be able to build our houses. We still sort of have that in our dialogue in WA and I think around Australia. And we think of the forest as being never ending. It goes on forever. And those little bits that we've clawed back for ourselves to be able to live in are really precious. We're on the brink, though, I think, of starting to really appreciate that the natural environment is a lot more than a commodity. It doesn't actually pose a threat to us. It takes care of us and it looks after us, and without it, we're stuffed. And that cultural shift is becoming evident in the community, and then slowly is becoming more palatable for government to be able to make the policy changes that are necessary that come off the back of that. Also, probably, maybe a shorter answer to your question is that in 2001, when we protected the old growth forest, according to the current definition anyway, the wind was really taken out of the sails of the campaign. It had been such a big campaign, so well known across the state and the country. And people wanted to believe that we'd won. So in 2001, when people were celebrating, I had this horrible feeling in my guts that we weren't finished, but that the campaign had gone, and what were we going to be left with? And it's been the last 20 years I've been really just fighting to put the spotlight back on the continued destruction in the forests.
Wow. You mentioned some of the cultural aspects there, and of course fire management is another aspect that's been in the news a lot lately in some, again, just sort of so nonsensical a way, but locked into quotas of burning and so forth and doing inordinate damage, while other states are really picking up the cultural burning aspect, turning to First Nations, empowering First Nations with custodianship in these sorts of manners that they know so well. Is there scope in the survey to highlight that this is important for people?
Yeah, there is. There's a couple of spots where you can talk about fire and also about mining, which is the other really major effect that impact on forests that often gets missed. There's only two places really where fire and mining come up as something that you can select as being something that you think needs to be managed. So I actually phoned and spoke to the person who put the survey together and is going to be managing the data, because there's some bits there that I really wasn't clear about, where they say which of these things need to be managed. What they mean is need to be hauled in and had a close look at. So that's where people should say fire and mining and native forest logging need to be managed. It doesn't mean you're saying they need to be done. It just means you're saying you recognise that they are happening and that someone needs to haul them in and have a close look at them.
Yes.
So, yeah, look, fire is having a major impact, and we've got this outrageous annual target of 200,000 hectares per year that needs to be burned, and wildfire is encountered in that. So if, 200,000 hectares of forest burn in a wildfire, they still aim for their 200,000 hectare target for prescribed burning, and it's having devastating impacts on biodiversity and individual populations of different species and, of course, on climate and health. And it needs to be it needs to be put under some serious scrutiny. And there's a lot of great science that has now been done and is being done. And of course, Aboriginal people have been looking after country for a bloody long time and have got the knowledge and the capacity. They need to be given some active custodianship from the policymakers and the agencies so that they can share that wisdom and science and knowledge with us so that we can be managing country more appropriately. And that is being done on smaller scales, but it needs to be done on a broader scale.
Yes. Amongst the other big achievements over the decades is a more recent 12-month moratorium on logging of the two-tiered Karri forest last year. So is that still in place, and is that part of what has led to this survey?
Yeah, so the first sort of win that we had just before the state election that we knew we were getting onto the right path was when that 12-month moratorium was extended for the next 3 years. And that's 10,000 hectares of old-growth Karri forest that should have been protected back in 2001 but wasn't because of the definition. It's now called two-tiered, which, you know, it's a bit of a strange term. People wouldn't really know what it means.
No.
It means that it's got an old growth and a regrowth component to it. So one or two trees might have been cut down in a 2-hectare area, which means it's been disqualified from old growth protection. So it's now called two-tiered. We finally, after all these years, managed to get those 10,000 hectares of Karri off the logging plans, which was just such a relief to me after such a long time of fighting for those forests. But certainly doesn't take us nearly far enough towards the protection of the forests that we have left. That gave us confidence that we really were setting the foundation well for this next phase of the campaign, which is making sure that the next 10-year forest management plan is a forest conservation plan. And the next step has been the release of this survey.
Okay. Meanwhile, WAFA has a plan that is taking all these learnings and what we need to do and putting it forward in a coherent framework, which involves indeed the finance, economic stuff, sustaining communities, transitioning, of course, in that sense, in a managed way, and protection of the forests in an integrated fashion, which is quite powerful and a terrific piece of work. So I was hoping we can leverage off this enormously. Do you want to run us through what led to that and the key components?
Yeah, I'd love to. So it's called Forests for Life, and there's a dedicated website to it that people can find. I was actually on maternity leave and unable to be out in the forest and, you know, doing a lot of the kind of normal campaigning that I do, and spending a lot of time thinking about what we needed to do to bring this to a close. So I started researching programs that have been in place in WA and also around Australia and the world that have grown timber sustainably. I didn't want to just copy the plantation model of fence-to-fence plant, tree plantings, which, come with their own challenges. I wanted to look at how we could be growing trees in association with continued farming practice and bring benefits for water quality and salinity and amenity and all those sorts of things onto farms, because I thought that was more likely to work. It was more likely to get up. And also, it brings benefits onto farmland.
Yeah, well, just on that, Jess, I see farmers packing out carbon farming workshops, trying to get a grip on the changes that are coming in that are ostensibly to incentivize them doing just this. So they are looking for ways to participate in the best fashion. It seems like a marriage made in heaven in that sense, you know, all come together with the same sort of overarching goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think when we kind of lift ourselves up and look over the landscape, one of the things that we would do, I think, if we had the benefit of hindsight, is we wouldn't have allowed for the clearing of all of those streams and rivers, would we? I mean, the impacts of that have just been so profound. We can't reverse that, but what we can do is protect all of the natural vegetation that we do have left and then start repairing where we've made these, you know, terrible errors. But there's no point going onto farms and shouting at farmers and telling them that they have to, you know, do that themselves. We need an integrated and holistic approach that's going to actually work, that farmers are going to be willing to take up. And so it's that stream and riparian veg restoration that has really motivated me. But at the same time, there are these obvious synergies, like you say, for the farmers, for potential income that's coming from these new economies, And also for avoided deforestation. So one of the other things that really motivates me is I don't want in 35 years' time for us to be importing timber from overseas because we've completely stuffed up our own timber production here, which we have and we're continuing to do. We need to get trees in the ground right now so that we're going to have our own timber, that our children are going to have their own timber, or they will be drawing on timber from other countries. So all of these things came together in my mind while I was sort of sitting at home with a baby.
That's wonderful, actually. I think that's a terrific sort of, well, it's a terrific birthplace for this, let's say that.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's got a kind of a maternal and and a relaxed synergizing rather than a rushed, combative kind of, so I think it's there is something in that. So the plan is for us to grow in two zones, in the southwest and the Great Southern, 40,000 hectares of high-value hardwood timber trees in association with existing cropping and grazing. And those would be East Coast eucalypts for the timber trees and then obviously natives for the permanent re-veg that's associated with it. And they're grown in such a way that the cropping or grazing can continue. And there's been excellent models for this in WA and around Australia. 40,000 is a minimum. It'd be better if we went higher than that, but that's the bare minimum for being able to get an economy of scale sort of situation so that you can build the processing centres, you can the contractors are going to be willing to go out to pull the wood back in. The trees have to be grown within 100 k's of the future processing centre, otherwise the transport costs become uneconomic.
Well, that's significant in itself, that there will be processing centres that we'll have the skills and the manufacturing base to actually do our own work again.
Yeah, that's right. And also they'll be centred where we've already had timber industry. So one will be centred on green bushes. All the roads are in already. There's, you know, a lot of people around there who have the skills and the history in the timber industry. And then the other around Albany. And it's like you said, when you're introducing this, we've drawn on the lessons of the past because there was mistakes made with the MAS scheme. One of them was that trees were grown too far away from future processing centres. Sometimes they were grown in the lots were too small. Sometimes the rainfall zone was wrong. The soil type was wrong. And it wasn't managed in such a way that had a view to how those trees were then going to be used in the future. It was kind of, let's just get trees in the ground. And obviously I'm a big fan of getting trees in the ground, but we have to do it in a way that is going to be considered to have been valuable for the people who put the trees in. Otherwise we just, they get bulldozed and burned, which is what we're seeing a lot of across the South Coast still.
Yes. And the management of the land over the millennia was never done in a haphazard fashion anyway. So it's just continuing a tradition. It's written how bad the current economy of this is going, the deforestation model. But on the other hand, you've got industries that are already massively outperforming that dying timber industry. So on the one hand, you're talking about let's institute a world-class timber industry, not get rid of one, but have a world-class level one and not the old third world model, actually get manufacturing and processing back. And then you're talking about, tourism, hospitality, beekeeping, extraordinarily underrated economic contribution. It is a real picture you're trying to paint of let's back what's already emerged. We don't even have to sort of pluck out of the sky what we know works down here. Stop the erosion of those things and then, back them in. Talk to us a little bit about those realities on the ground that you've observed.
Well, that's really just come out of the business sector. You know, people have approached us and said, particularly with the honey industry most recently, that they're losing forests where their apiary sites are, that there's hardly any places where they can have their bees because of there's fewer and fewer areas available for them because of logging and then also fire. Climate change is having a huge impact. Bees can kind of act as a bit of a litmus test or a canary in the coal mine for how well a forest is performing, because it can look like a forest is doing really well. It's got great flower every, couple of years when it should be there. But the bees come back down to the hive and they haven't got any, there wasn't any pollen up there. So the beekeepers are quite often the people who are seeing the declining health of the forest. And then, experiencing that in a financial sense as well. So we've been approached by lots of people in the honey industry, but then also accommodation providers who've said, I'm getting these half-star ratings on my Airbnb site all of a sudden because people have been woken up by logging machinery.
Wow.
Yeah. And banging on their door at 3 a.m. because they, you know, they can't sleep because the machine, you know, several people in Pemberton area have been reporting that. And then avocado growers who the neighbouring forest is clearfelled and all of a sudden the wind is so severe that their avocados aren't growing. You know, real tangible impacts on local businesses, small scale and then also really big scale. We've just been really heartened, though, by how smart and dedicated and thoughtful a lot of the players in those sectors are and how willing they are to come to work together to make really excellent media commentary, to start talking to decision makers. So this really organic alliance is now forming where our job is to be very clear about what's good for the forests and the forest health in and of itself. And the job of the business sector is to highlight that protected forests are actually better for the Southwest for the social and economic considerations. And together we're telling a pretty powerful story, I think, that the timber industry really is just does, the native forest timber industry, that is, just does not belong in the 21st century.
There was a terrific Clean State short film with Mikey Chinotta, a honey producer, and he said, one tonne of Jarrah firewood is worth about $300. One tonne of Jarrah honey is worth $30,000. That's landed pretty strongly with people to illustrate your point. And then, of course, yeah, we've touched on, but let's highlight, because they're hugely significant, the soil, water and climate connections and benefits related to this. I'm conscious that with industry sort of playing its part then, what is your sense of the public support for this? Is that it's really sort of clamoring to a crescendo as well?
Yeah, definitely. There was some polling done at the end of 2019 that showed 68%, I think it was, somewhere between 65 and 68% of West Australians wanted to see the full protection of Southwest forests. And a year later, at the end of 2020, it was 78% of people. So, you know, it was the same question, you know, clearly a very significant increase in people's understanding. And look, yeah, I mean, I think anecdotally we all know you can't, it's difficult to find anybody who thinks that logging native forests for wood chip, charcoal and firewood is a good idea.
Yes.
And then at an international level, you know, you're talking about climate, the IUCN has shown that 1/3 of all of the climate mitigation effort that we need globally must come from protecting forests. So it's not an insignificant contribution that native forests play. And we've got 850,000 hectares here that are still available for logging. So when we make a policy change, which I think is on the horizon now, and we protect that 850,000 hectares, that's a significant contribution that we have made to continuing to draw carbon down out of the atmosphere and to protecting biodiversity. And in terms of water, you know, the loss that we've already brought to this landscape is immense. And what some scientists at UWA's Water Research Centre have shown is that more than 50% of the rainfall decline in the southwest of WA is a result of land clearing. So that should empower us to say we can make this significant contribution by protecting the forest at a global level, but also it really gives us the capacity to build local resilience because we need rainfall down here. Mm-hmm. And forests bring and make rain. So, you know, the sooner we protect what's left and start restoring where we can, the better.
Mm, beautifully said, and a great way to wrap up. Thanks a lot, Jess.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Jess Beckerling, convener and campaign director of the WA Forest Alliance. For more on Jess and WAFA, including a link to the survey and a guide to help filling it in, see the links in the show notes. You'll also find more there about Clean State WA and how you can support its jobs plan or get involved with climate initiatives and other action in your community. And if you'd like to hear more on how people are coming together to create livelihoods that heal country in the magnificent Southwest, join me for a few recent episodes over on the Regeneration podcast. That link's also in the show notes. The music you're hearing is by Selfless Orchestra, an emergence of WA musicians inspired by issues of social and environmental justice. My name's Anthony James. Thanks again for listening.